Well, good afternoon, and I'm going to, as I said, not continue the sermon on women. We'll bring that back next time. If you want titles, the title of this, and this isn't literally a PowerPoint, I don't have any text up there, just pictures, but the title will be called The Rhetoric of Reversal, Rhetoric of Reversal, if you like titles. And I got that particular phrase from a professor at, boy, I almost can't read up here. I've got to turn the lights out. Stonehill College. Mary Joan, she's got a lot of names here. Mary Joan Wynn Leith. And some of the points here and the idea partially came, or a lot of it came from her and a lecture that I saw of hers online. Rhetoric of reversal. What's that mean? It's the idea that you turn an assumption, something we all agree is true, turn it upside down, make a point. It's a lot of fairy tales are that way, right? You expect it's going to turn out this way, and boom, it turns out the other way to make a point. Some years ago, I gave a sermon. It's interesting, we were in Genesis 2 and 3 today. And I gave a sermon on creation stories. If you may have been here. If not, it's probably still online. And what I was demonstrating that I had discovered just in studying the creation stories is that there are a lot of similarities between, let's say, the Elumelish, which is the Babylonian creation story. There are also other creation stories that I read from. There are similarities between them and what we read in Genesis. And what makes that interesting to me, or made it interesting to me, and one of the things I commented about was that it brought out to me the polemical nature of the beginning of the book of Genesis. That is, that it's making a point, it's making an argument, it's arguing a point. You know, in Babylon, we worship the sun. And with Yahweh's religion, he made the sun. He made the sun. You know, and not only that, he didn't get around to it, according to the account, until the fourth day. So, you know, you worship the sun, our God made it. On the fourth day, when he got around to it, he had some other things to do first. You see, it's to make a point. It's almost to get a dig in there and say, you know, what you have isn't the way it really is. In the Babylonian creation stories, the gods, they were fighting each other and so forth, and they created mankind to serve them as slaves. And as Josh was reading today, Adam and Eve were put in the garden to have a job, to have dominion, and to help God in taking care of the earth, not to be a slave, but actually God was sharing his existence with it in a way. He's delegating some responsibility to human beings. So that in the sermon, I was just pointing out how there's all these different ways that it's written, regardless of exactly how it happened. The point is, it's written in a way to draw a distinction between this is the way God does things, and this is the way you think that your gods do it. And that was obvious to me in the book of Genesis. It had never been obvious to me in another place, and that's where we're going today. And that's where I got the idea from this particular professor. And that is that in the beginning of the book of Exodus, just like in the beginning of the book of Genesis, in the beginning of the book of Exodus, there's many examples. And I'm telling you up front what we're doing, and maybe you'll get to some, maybe you'll be ahead of me and guess some of them. Or figure them out, not guess them. But there are role reversals. There are ways that we assume things to be, the way that Egyptians assume things to be. That when God came into the picture, or Yahweh, you know, the particular God of the Hebrews, came into the picture, it's turned on its head, turned upside down. And that's what I'm going to discuss today. This is a preview of some of the types of things that I will be speaking about while I'm in Thailand. I get a lot of opportunities to speak during the holy days. I simplify, you know, obviously it'll be a very simplified version because of the translation issues and so forth, but I will talk about this, how in the Bible turns pagan ideas and man's ideas on its head, on their heads, I should say. Turns them upside down, approaches from a different way. So the writers of the book of Exodus, or perhaps tweaking by editors later on, they took the story, the basic story, and then wrote it up in such a way that it makes what to me are some very interesting points, and I want to share some of those points with you. Some of them I got from this lecture by this particular professor. Some of them are obvious and you get on your own. Some of them came from other sermons that I prepared. But I think it might do a couple of things. It will get our minds or continue to keep our minds on the subject at hand, which are the spring holidays, and also show us from the Bible again how our God, you know, the Christian God, is so different from the ways of the world. And that's one of the important messages of the first 11 chapters of Genesis, and as you'll see today, of the first 15 chapters of Exodus. Got to make sure I don't miss anything. It's kind of dark. In Egypt, okay, who is in charge? These are not hard questions. Pharaoh. Pharaoh is king, and Pharaoh is what else? God. Pharaoh's king, Pharaoh's God. All right, they got that on this side. That's simple enough. Then in Israel, we have the contention that Yahweh is king and Yahweh is God. So here it's got obvious. You set the scene, and it's clear in the book of Genesis. That's the scene that's set. Is that you have Pharaoh on the one hand, you have Yahweh on the other hand, and we're going to have a colossal battle. That's what's going to be the way it's going to be written up. And the question is, who's king, and who is God? And we'll look at various. As we go through this, and I'm going to go through it rather rapidly, we'll see various issues and various ways that what is expected is turned on its head. Well, this isn't going to work because I turned it off, turned it back on. There we go. Okay. You know what we have there. This is one of the first ones that comes to mind. Pharaoh decided at the beginning. Oh, thank you.
Maybe a little bit. I don't know.
Is that going to stay there?
I don't know.
Oh, thanks.
It does.
Yeah. If I have a particular problem, I can shine it on there. Thank you. What's one of the first things that Pharaoh does in the story in the book of Exodus? Issues an edict. What? Kill the infants. We think, well, you throw them into the Nile, they're going to drown. Maybe, but there's something else that's in the Nile. You know, one way or the other, they're going to die. And that's why I got the picture. That happens to be a Nile crocodile. Pharaoh decides that the Hebrew boys are going to die. That's his way. That's the Egyptian way, right? The Israelite children are going to die. In the end of the story, you get to the 10th plague, and what happens? Who dies? His son, the Egyptian sons. So there's just that's right at the get-go. You have one of these things where, you know, the Egyptian desire is we're going to do this, and it's exactly the opposite that happens. And it's written in that way. It's almost a foreshadowing. You know, and of course there were the Egyptian, we know that the midwives got around that anyway. Also, not only is it a fact that Pharaoh's children, or Pharaoh's, the firstborn of Pharaoh died, just like he tried to kill the Hebrew children, but he threw them in, he instructed that they be thrown into the Nile, right? They're going to drown in the water. How did Pharaoh die? Pharaoh drowned in the water. This stuff's pretty obvious. It didn't jump out at me, though, until somebody else brought it to my attention. But Pharaoh drowns in the water. It's his desire to drown the Israelites in the water. He drowns in the water. Well, we're going to see this kind of thing happening quite a bit here. One of the things that is in a lot of myth in Egypt, and it was part of the Egyptian myths. It's actually in other myths as well. This is a picture of somebody took of some papyrus reeds on the banks of the Nile. So perhaps wherever Moses was hidden looked something like this. But there was a myth that was associated with all the pharaohs. And this myth went like this. It was, you have Isis and Osiris and Horus, right? Horus is the sun, and Horus was going to be king, but there was somebody, it was Seti or somebody, I forget who, that was an enemy, and Horus had to be hidden for a while. Well, guess where he was hidden? Well, he was hidden in the reeds of the Nile. That's where he was hidden for a while. And, you know, it all worked out for good, and Horus was preserved, and he became king. Horus is a god, actually, later on. But this is the way the story went. Well, this particular story was associated with all the pharaohs because there wasn't a whole lot of distinction between pharaoh and god in Egypt. So this was one of those things as part of the culture that was associated with all the pharaohs. And yet, when you read the book of Exodus, who is it that's hidden in the reeds? Moses. Not Horus, it's Moses. And actually, Moses is a threat to Pharaoh, just as Horus in this story perceived a threat from somebody. Well, Pharaoh rightly perceives a threat from Moses, because in the end, Moses gets the better of Pharaoh, right? We think Pharaoh is powerful. Not only is he powerful, how many powerful kingdoms? I don't know the answer to this, but how many powerful kingdoms were there at the time of the Exodus? You had Egypt, which was a powerful kingdom. You had the Hittite kingdom to the north. And perhaps you had something off in Asia. You know, I don't know what the Chinese or the Indians were doing at that time. I don't know enough about history. But in that part of the world, you had the Egyptians and you had the Hittites. And they were very powerful. And as is the case later on between Egypt and Greece and Egypt and Babylon and so forth, what we call the Holy Land, Palestine, is right in the middle of Hittite control and Egyptian control. But Egyptian culture was like the tops in the world. I mean, they had the knowledge, they had the society, they had people, they had a very rich and prosperous society that could afford to have full-time priests and full-time type people. You know, you had to have a prosperous society in order to have people that could make a living doing something that wasn't productive, that wasn't growing food or making something that was needed for living. And Egypt was one of those societies, just like ours is today. So again, just like you have Pharaoh trying to kill the Hebrew babies, and his child is killed in the end, just like he's trying to kill him in the water and he's killed by the water, you have the story that the Pharaoh is kind of associated with as being hidden in the reeds, and it was actually Moses that was hidden in the reeds, and Moses is going to be the one that's going to be the undoing of Pharaoh, the way it turns out. Now, I want to turn out one other thing, kind of a little minor issue that I had never noticed before. But in Exodus chapter 1 and verse 3, nah, that can't be right. Exodus 1 and verse 8, probably. Exodus 1 verse 8, and you don't need to turn there for that. It just says, there came up a new king over Egypt who did not know Joseph. And this is what I didn't know, is that word know has connotations. It just doesn't mean, you know, hi, I'm good to know you. It has to do with a covenant. That word has to do with covenant. The word has to do with an agreement, an arrangement. And there certainly was definitely an agreement, arrangement of relationship between Pharaoh and Joseph, and Pharaoh and Joseph's father Jacob, and so forth. And then we get to a time in history years later when you have a Pharaoh who doesn't know. In other words, he does not honor that arrangement. He does not honor that covenant that had been made with the Israelites. And when we get to Exodus chapter 6, and Yahweh is going to become involved in this, right? And he's decided what, you know, he's made it clear what he's going to do. And I'll begin reading in verse 3 of chapter 6. It says, and I appeared unto Abraham, this is God speaking, I appeared unto Abraham and unto Isaac and unto Jacob, and by the name of God Almighty, because my name Yahweh was not known, I was not known to them by that name. And I've established a covenant with them. So God, here we have pointed out early in the book of Exodus that God is a God who establishes covenants, just like Pharaoh established a covenant with Joseph. But Pharaoh didn't keep his covenant. But God is going to be presented as someone who's very different than that. A covenant with them in the land of Canaan, where they were strangers. And verse 5 says, I've heard the groaning of the children of Israel, whom the Egyptians keep in bondage. And I have remembered my covenant. Wherefore, say to the children of Israel, I am the Lord, I am Yahweh, I will bring you out from under the burdens of the Egyptians. And I could keep reading there. You can go on down to verse 8, I guess. But I don't need to read all that. The point is, once again, we have it presented in the beginning of the book of Exodus that Pharaoh, for all of his wonderful qualities, is a covenant breaker. But Yahweh, who is really God and really king, is not a covenant breaker. In fact, he remembers his covenant that he made hundreds of years ago with the father of the Israelites, Abraham, and with his children, grandchildren, and so forth. So there's another thing right at the beginning of the book, before we even get into some specific actions. It's all characterized that in Egypt, there's one set of standards, but when God sets about doing things, it's an entirely different situation. And in this case, God is not a covenant breaker, he's a covenant keeper. Pharaoh is a covenant breaker. All right. Whom do the gods love the most? Who's the favorite of the gods in any culture, any society, anciently? Who's the favorite? I don't think so. King. I think the king is a better answer. Sure, certainly the priest is going to be a favorite, but the king is he's the man, as we say these days. He's the one that really has the relationship. Here you have what is this particular picture? I can't see it big enough. That's the Amun-Re, who is sitting on the throne. That's supposed to be one of that's the sun god. And you have the Pharaoh making some kind of a presentation there. And it's the Pharaoh who's the special one to the gods. The Pharaoh is associated with the gods. He's one of the gods in a way, but he's certainly the special one. He's the favorite. He's the number one son, you might say, in some ways. And that's typical. That's typical of any society in the ancient world. God loves the king the best. And Pharaoh was sometimes in the I'm not an Egyptologist, and I don't have any particular things here. I wouldn't know how to read it anyway in the hieroglyphics, but they've translated to where sometimes the Pharaoh is called the son of God. Okay? The son of God. So Pharaoh is the favorite. He's the favorite of the gods. Not only that, he's the son of God. Who is, now we're just sticking in the book of Exodus for now. Who is the son of God in the book of Exodus? Anybody know? Exodus 4, verse 22 says, this is where God's telling Moses what to say to Pharaoh. He says, say to Pharaoh, thus says the Eternal, Israel is my son, even my firstborn. So it's not Pharaoh who's the son of God, it's Israel. And once again, we get into this topsy-turviness, this upside-downness, if you want to call it that, this reversal. And that's the way the entire account is written. It's not Pharaoh who's the son of God, it's Israel that's the son of God. My firstborn, my special, not Pharaoh. Not only is Pharaoh special and the favorite, but where does he get his authority? Where does Pharaoh's authority come from? It comes from the gods. This is a picture of Horus, a representation of Horus, one of the gods of Egypt, right behind the Pharaoh. I've got your back. I give you your authority. I'm the one who transfers authority to you. The gods give the pharaohs their authority. Here's another picture. This is, which god is this? This is Amun-Re again. You see the great big two double-headed, whatever that thing is that's on his head, is blessing Hatshepsut, who wasn't a he. She was a she, a pharaoh. But there's the transfer of authority. You can see the god's hands reaching out to Hatshepsut, however you say her name, reaching out. The god is transferring his authority to the pharaoh, or transferring some of his authority and giving pharaoh authority. Of course, in the first part of the book of Exodus, who is it to whom God gives authority? Is it Pharaoh? No. It's Moses. Once again, we're getting this set up to where you've got Moses is set up as the antithesis, you might say, to Pharaoh. God has delegated a bit of authority to Moses. He tells Moses to go to Pharaoh. Here's what I want you to tell Pharaoh. So God gives authority too, but he's not giving it to the king. He's giving it to someone who is a Hebrew, who was rescued from the waters, who's a nobody in some senses. No, he wasn't a nobody because he had position in Egypt and so forth. But he was, he was not the Pharaoh. He was not the king. He was not a king and never was. Not only that, but I'll get into this a little later. Not only is it the gods who give authority to the king, to the pharaoh, but what do the plagues show? I'm going to get there a little later, but what do the plagues show in this same context? What are they a demonstration of? Anybody? I mean, there could be a lot of answers here. Absolutely. That's what I was looking for. That in Egypt they had a whole pantheon. They had dozens, if not hundreds, I don't know, of gods that controlled everything, every aspect of life. And the plagues on Egypt were a selective demonstration that couldn't do maybe all of the gods in just 10 plagues, but God one by one or two by two, however you want to do it, and we'll go through them just real quickly in a little bit. Demonstrated not only is Pharaoh's authority come from these gods, but these gods are nothing. God, Yahweh, has control over all that, as Tammy said. So really the Pharaoh's authority doesn't amount to much because it's only derived from these gods who have no power at all, as is demonstrated in the plagues. So again, you've got this, it's all set up and it's written, it's like we have this battle, this titanic battle between Pharaoh and Yahweh. It's not really much of a battle, but it's set up that way. It's written that way. It's written in that style to make the point that Pharaoh doesn't even compare. So, and once again, Moses, when God gave authority in this particular situation, he gave it to Moses, who was not king. And not only did Pharaoh, was he king, not only was he God, but I don't know how to describe this. I think it was more important in the ancient world, and I'm not an expert enough to maybe make it real clear, but he was the big man. You know, there's a certain connotation to Pharaoh. Pharaoh is not just this individual that looks a little bit like you and me, maybe even smaller. When you see the mummies, of course, they're dead. They don't look that great. But you see the mummies or you see pictures of how they're recreated to have looked when they were alive. And these people weren't giant people at all. But they were made to be. They were made to be giants. To give the impression that these people are great and powerful. It kind of reminds me when we were in France, of Chambord, the castle. It's a huge castle, and it's tall, and it has lawns that go out for hundreds of yards. And if you want to approach this castle, you've got to walk up this long, or riding your carriage, whatever, this long, long road, like this aisle here, it just goes on for like a half mile. And King, who was it that was there? I can't even remember. I should know that. I don't know remember my history. But anyway, the guy was, the Holy Roman Emperor or whatever was up there. You know, he's looking at this, and it makes it clear. If you didn't know before, you know who's in charge, because whoever it is has got to walk or ride his horse or whatever up this long half mile, three quarters of a mile road, you know, going up while somebody's up about 50 feet, 60 feet, looking down on all this. So the picture tells everything. The picture tells everything. And sometimes it's very helpful to look at the iconography, however you say that word, of things in the ancient world, maybe even in our world today, to see what it's really like. Look at the advertisements, you know, today. If you want to see how the world really is, sometimes maybe you just need to look at those things, the things that are bigger than life. Well, look at this. This is a picture of Ramses. Most of the pictures I have here that are pharaohs are Ramses, because Ramses was perhaps the pharaoh of the Exodus, at least around that time. And plus, there's lots of pictures and statues of Ramses all over the place. And obviously, this particular statue is quite large if you look at the human being that's next to his head in this museum. But this is nothing. This is nothing. Pharaoh was a huge figure in Egyptian thought. And here's it's hard to tell what you're looking at here, but that's actually just the head of a particular statue, the head and maybe the shoulders. The shoulders of this statue, this is the one that, who is it, Shelley wrote about Ozymandias, whatever, the huge statue. This statue, the shoulders are about 7 meters. They're about 21 feet from one shoulder to the other. And here's, you know, some picture I got off the internet. Somebody just happened to snap a picture as a tourist of someone standing at Ozymandias' head. That's Ramses II. That's who that was. And so they had statues of Ramses everywhere and of every other pharaoh. Because the pharaoh was the big man. The pharaoh was, he was it. And not only was he big man, he was everywhere. This is at the temple at Luxor. You think, who are all those statues? All those people, they're all one person. They're all Ramses. So not only is he big man, he's everywhere. It's like the old Chicken Man series. He's everywhere. You know, you can't ever escape. It's kind of a counterfeit of God's omnipresence, you know. The king is everywhere. His statue is everywhere. You can't get away from it. Not only that, if you were an Egyptian, you didn't know, and in those days, you didn't know how everything worked. And these statues had some kind of magical power. You know, it wasn't just stone. I mean, you knew it was stone, but they become inhabited in a way by the gods. So they're everywhere. Why are they everywhere? Why, if you were Pharaoh, or if you were in the government of Egypt, why would you put these huge statues of the Pharaoh everywhere? And why would you put lots of statues everywhere? What's the point of that? There could be a lot, but what do you think? What are you doing that for? Make the people fear you. I think that's a good one. Control. You're everywhere. You can't get out from under the nose of the king. You think this is an ancient, 3,000-year-old way of doing things? No. Ray says no. It's a 21st-century way of doing things. I've talked to people that grew up in Cuba. They had block captains that had every block had somebody that reported on everything you did, and it went up the channel, and depending on up the chain of command, depending on how subversive it was assumed to be, it would go up higher. I've got a friend that lives in Burma that told me the same thing today. It's still like that in Burma. You got people in the community that report on you to the government. So, yes, it's everywhere. How about, I'm going to Thailand, and I don't guess anybody's ever been to Thailand, but if you ever go, one thing you'll notice, assuming that this king and queen are still alive, well, Shelby's been there. What do you notice? They're everywhere. Now, they are in Bangkok. He's in the hospital. She's usually with him. Hospital, kind of like an apartment. But the figures are plastered everywhere, on the side of buildings, on billboards, on signs, on calendars in every public place. The picture of the king is everywhere.
Mailboxes.
Where?
Mailboxes.
Mailboxes. I forgot that. The picture of the king is everywhere. Sometimes the queen, but always the king. And I'm not being critical of that. You can say it's because they admire and adore their king. They do. But it's more than that. It's more than that because he's semi a god. He's viewed as somewhat of a god by at least the older people in Thailand. So it's still like that today. It hasn't changed. But Pharaoh was everywhere. Pharaoh was the big man. He's the powerful man. Once again, now, who is it to set up against Pharaoh?
Moses.
Moses is not really portrayed as a big man. He's the baby that was rescued from the reeds. God chose him. And what does Exodus talk about when it talks about God chose him? Moses said, I'm your man. I'm ready to go. Woo! I got it in for Pharaoh. Is that what he says? What's he say? Not me. Come on, really. I don't want to go. Now, it could have been a lot of reasons for that. One is he could have feared he was going to die. Well, I stutter, I this, I that, you know. Now, Stephen, a lot of years later, says that he was great in words and deeds. So maybe maybe Moses was exaggerating his stuttering. I don't know. Stephen seemed to think he was a good orator. But for whatever reason, Moses was not, he's telling God, I'm not your man. Please, somebody else. All right, I'll send Aaron. Aaron can talk for you, you know. So here you got the big man. You know, you look at these things. You got your huge Ramses, and you got Moses. But who wins? It's that reversal. It's that reversal. That's the way it's written. To me, that's interesting. So not only is Pharaoh big, but he's everywhere. He's everywhere. Now, another thing that's very important in Egypt. When you talk about Egypt, you talk about Pharaoh. Everybody talks about pharaohs in Egypt and pyramids and that kind of thing. But when you talk about Egypt, the land, what's the most important thing?
Nile.
The Nile River. The Nile River, why is it most important?
Food, water.
You know, Egypt is not known for being a fertile land, but boy, around the Nile, it is. And because of that, actually the Nile, in a way, because you recognize that, you say, well, the Nile, that Egypt's all about the Nile and the Nile is all about Egypt. In a way, the Nile kind of defines Egypt. It's like they're one and the same, you know? And it pictures fertility. It's the one sure thing, you know, that water just keeps on rolling. Isn't that one of, what's the song? I can't remember, some American song about some water key. Oh, well, there's several of them. Old Man River or Proud Mary, or it's all water keeps on rolling. You know, that's what the water does. It keeps coming. And not only that, it floods, if you're in the Nile, it floods on a regular schedule so that you can put the silt out everywhere, get the water out there on the fields, and get the fertile soil out on the fields. The Nile is life-giving. It is the center of life. It kind of pictures life in Egypt. What's good for the Nile is good for Egypt. It's kind of like we used to say about GM, right? What's good for GM is good for America. Well, what's good for the Nile is good for Egypt. And what's bad for the Nile is bad for Egypt. Of course, what was the first plague? First plague was on the Nile, wasn't it? God's making the point that this whole thing is not going to be good for Egypt. Because this is going to be bad for the Nile, which is bad for Egypt. Because the Nile picture, it symbolized life. Here's a picture. I don't know how big it looks for you. That's just a picture somebody took from an airplane when they were coming into I guess when they were coming into land or taking off there in Egypt. Now, what does that tell you? You know, you Ray said it's life, it's water, it's food. So you see, you got. I'm going to step out here. What's that line there? The line between what?
Green. That's the growing area.
That's the line between where it's got any moisture at all and where it's dry. If you're not near the Nile, you're not near anything when it comes to life and fertility. So that's just a good aerial picture there showing the real truth about that the Nile is all important. Here's a satellite photo. You see the Nile River? Now, you're not looking at the river there. You're looking at the river and, you know, however many miles it is close to the river that are fertile and irrigated. And once you get outside of that, it's a desert. But the whole delta is very fertile. Down here. And for what it's worth, just while we're at this picture, because I've been doing some more research into the Exodus, the time of the Exodus, and so forth. It's very possible, according to some people's research, that at the time of the Exodus, at the coastline, the Mediterranean coastline went something like this. It wasn't out here. That's a couple thousand years of deposits from the Nile. But the coastline used to come in like this. And for what it's worth, there's all these lakes. It's marshy now, but it used to be these lakes. There were lakes all the way from the coast, which was right about here, from the coast on in toward what we call the Red Sea now. There were a lot of lakes in here. I'll just keep going. The word that's translated Red Sea in most of our translations, English translations, that Red Sea, that's the way the Septuagint, the Greek translation of the Old Testament, that's the way it translated it, which would indicate it's down here or here. But actually the word is reeds. It's Reed Sea. And it's likely that it might have been talking to some of these lakes up here. The word is reeds, which is interesting. We'll get to that in a minute. It's the same word for reed. It's not red, it's reed. Anyway, you see how fertile the land is anywhere near the Nile, where they can irrigate. So the Nile is all about life. And you get to the first plague, and the Nile's turned to blood. Actually, not just the first plague, but way before the first plague. What in the way the account is written in Exodus, what is the Nile? All right, I should back up. As Ray said, the Nile has to do with life and food. What's good for the Nile is good for the country. In the book of Exodus, what is the Nile associated with? Life? What's the first thing we read about? Pharaoh says, throw the Israelite boys into the Nile. The Nile is associated with death. First plague. Nile's turned to blood, and everything in it dies. So, in Egyptian culture, in the Egyptian ideal, the Nile is all about life. In the book of Exodus, God says, it's all, actually even Pharaoh at first, but then God says the Nile's going to be about death. Because this isn't a good story for Egypt. This isn't a good incident, part of their history. It's not going to be good for Egypt. It's going to be bad for Egypt. And the Nile, instead of symbolizing life, in the beginning of the book of Exodus, the Nile symbolizes death. It's the opposite. It's a reversal. This just amazed me that there were so many of these. Not that there are any at all, but that there are so many in this story. Got the plague of blood. And, you know, one thing, that the Nile floods. When we have a flood, sometimes we go, oh, no, that's terrible. In Egypt, it would be terrible if it didn't flood. It flooded. It flooded regularly, on schedule. You knew it was going to flood. If it didn't flood, you weren't going to have a good season. Flooding's good when it's the Nile. If the Nile's not doing what it's supposed to do, that's more of a symbolism of chaos You know, the things aren't going well. And the Pharaoh is in charge of keeping things on schedule and normal and keeping chaos away. Chaos, anything that is dangerous for the Egyptian way of life. That's Pharaoh's job. We'll talk about that just a little bit more in a minute. He's supposed to keep Egyptian people and keep Egypt chaos free. Okay. I already mentioned Horus, and I went ahead of myself talking about the story of Horus and the reeds. So I don't need to go there, although I got some pictures to go with it, I think. Yeah, here's the picture of Horus. Now, maybe you can't make this out. But Horus, as a baby, you see this? That's a leaf. It's a lotus leaf curled in, right? This is actually on a little statuette from, of all places, Samaria in the 8th century, at the time that Israel was conquered. All right, so here you got an Egyptian god, or a king, as a baby, who's protected in a lotus leaf that looks a lot like what? Huh? A boat? Basket? Okay? So that's getting back to the story that I'm telling you, that this Horus was protected in the reeds, just like we read about Moses. Moses is protected in the reeds. That's just a picture here. But that's a real picture. That's or not real, but it's a couple thousand years old anyway, to almost 3,000 years old. And there's your evidence that Horus is depicted as being in some kind of a boat contraption, something that protects him from the water. Lotus leaves, of course, float on the water, and you got the water underneath of him there. So anyway, that's the pictures that go with it. I got ahead of myself talking about the story. And didn't wait for the pictures to come up. Another thing that I could spend more time on, but I won't. And this goes back to the fact that Pharaoh is depicted as the big man, right? He's not just depicted as any big man. In fact, what I learned is that Hatshepsut, when she was Pharaoh, for her ceremonial roles anyway, had to don, guess what, a beard. I guess like the judges in the old days used to have to wear the powdered wig. She had to put a beard on because being Pharaoh was a manly thing, even if you're a woman. Anyway, Pharaoh was not just the big man, but he was a big virile man. He was a man's man, right? He was powerful. He had rulership over his enemies. And you could go on and on. We could go into more detail about some of the words that are used in there, and I won't. Might hint at it later. But Pharaoh is this big hero, right? Big hero. In the book of Exodus, in the beginning of the book of Exodus, we've set it up, and I've given the explanation here, and you're right on with me here, that Moses is set as the antithesis to Pharaoh. But who is it that gets the better of Pharaoh in the story? Who gets the better in the specific examples? Who is it? And I don't mean who is it a person, but what people get the better of this man of man's, the big man Pharaoh? Who is it to get the better of him? When Pharaoh commanded that all the Hebrew babies, boys, be killed, who frustrated his goals? The midwives, the women. Miriam and his mother, Jochebed, they frustrate him. Not only that, but his own daughter. He doesn't have a, it sounds like he doesn't have a son. He's only got a daughter. The way it's written, it's like it's this big man of men, Pharaoh, the big tough guy, and it's the women that outsmart him. And who celebrates in the end when you get to Exodus 15? Who's doing the celebrating? Miriam and the women. The horse and his rider is thrown into the sea. They're dancing and having a party. The women are given a prominent role in the beginning of the book of Exodus because they played a prominent role, of course, but also it's kind of like, remember, we're old enough to remember the Tom Paxson song from the 60s. My dog's bigger than your dog. My dog's bigger than yours. Right? Remember that? He's bigger. He bites mailmen. All right. It's kind of like that. You know, it's written in that style, in a sense. Nah, nah, we got you. In fact, it's in the song. Tom Paxson. Nah, 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 nah. One of the verses. I'm not saying that Exodus is childish. I don't mean it that way. But it's polemical. It's making a point. Our God's better than your God. Our everything's better than your whatever you have. And not only that, our women can beat your men. You see, it's all there. It's a reversal. Okay. Let's talk about the plagues real quick. I think I might have done this before if I haven't. This is another thing I cover when I go to Thailand. As Tammy said, there were gods for everything in Egypt. And the Nile god, for instance, was the Apis bull. And Hughes talked about this and some of the fantastic lengths that they went to bury and embalm these. There was one particular one who was always, it was the special bull that they had. It was actually a live one that they had at one of their temples or whatever. But they had the bull. They had Isis. Okay, one of the goddesses. She was the goddess of the Nile. And they also had this, I don't know how to say his name, Bnum or something like that. He was a ram. He was depicted with a ram's head. And he was the god who was in charge of protecting the Nile. So you had here three gods and other gods that were tangentially connected to the Nile. And so when the Nile's turned to blood and things in it die, all these gods are, they have no power against Yahweh. No power. Then there's a plague of frogs, right? You have frogs. This is Heket, I think is how you say it. Usually it's depicted as a female. Maybe you can't tell here, but can you tell what her head is? It's a frog. It's got a frog's head. One of the gods or goddesses of Egypt. She was the goddess of birth, okay? I don't have a picture. The flies. There was supposed to be a goddess or god of that has a head of a fly, Eutychet, and I couldn't get a picture that showed a fly's head. So there's supposed to be one anyway. Livestock were attacked, right? There was a plague on livestock. And here you had the Apis bull, you had the ram's head, you had Gnum, and you also had Hathor. Hathor being the one over here. And all of these you might call livestock gods. But they're powerless against Yahweh. You have the sores. You have the sores. You have Isis again as the goddess of healing. She was supposed to be the goddess of healing. Then you had the hail, where the heavens are out of control, where you have this very damaging hail that's coming. There were all kinds of gods that were involved with controlling what came from the skies, including Nut. And this picture, this is a typical way that the heavens and the earth were depicted in the old days, that you had this Nut. It's the things that happen with respect to the earth are controlled by this god. This is the stars and planets and so forth. And then, the heavens that are closer to the earth and so forth. But you have Nut, or however you would say that, I'm not sure. The sky god. You had Seti, this was the god that was supposed to control the storms. And Osiris. Osiris was the god of crops and fertility. And Osiris would have the responsibility of protecting the crops. And, of course, the hail destroyed the crops. And when the locusts came, Osiris would be responsible there as well, when the locusts destroyed the crops there. Now you had the plague of darkness, and that's a huge one, because they worshiped the sun, right? The Amun-Re, or Re, the sun god. And the plague of darkness is a direct attack on that God. And this, he was the most important God. You see a lot of depictions of this God in connection with the pharaohs and in other important roles. So, very briefly, that's just a demonstration with pictures of what Tammy was talking about, that the plagues were not just random. They were targeted on the chief gods of Egypt. All right, a couple more role reversals and we'll wrap up. One of them has to do with foreigners. One of the things that made Egypt a secure place was the fact that the pharaoh had control, can make it good for Egyptians. There had always been foreigners, in and around, but he had control of them, and he kept things peaceful. This is an interesting picture. This is supposed to be Ramses again, and Ramses is, there are, can you tell what he's got in his hands? Can anybody tell? I don't know how clear that is. Huh? Nobody can tell?
Is this supposed to be like,
I got a close-up, but huh?
Is this supposed to be like grain or like wheat or something? And it's like, so what do you mean? You mean the one stretched out?
Hair. Oh, wait, what's that one?
So he's pulling his hair.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. He's got some people that perhaps he doesn't like by the hair. Okay? I got a close-up here. Now, you see the close-up on the right? It's three faces, one being more of an African-looking face and two of them being more Asian or Middle Eastern. What's the problem with them? Do they look like the pharaoh? Look at the picture there. They're smaller, yeah. That's a depiction. That's part of, are they really smaller? No. They're the same size, might be bigger, but they'd have less power, so that's why the picture's drawn that way. But do they look like, do the facial features look like? No. So they are not just other people, they are foreigners. They don't look like Egyptians. And what does this tell you? It tells you, we have nothing to fear because Pharaoh's in control. He's got them all by the hair. He can drag them where he wants to. He can control the foreigners. And that's part of the job of the Pharaoh, is to control the foreigners. Now, here's an interesting picture. You're not going to know what this is. Well, it's supposed to be, it's a Ramses Sphinx, or maybe it's not Ramses, I forget, but let's see if we can
see how big it looks for you. Okay. Any idea what these things are? You can't really see too much. Maybe you can see one there.
Are they boats?
Boats?
Yeah.
No. Not supposed to be.
Swords?
They're supposed to be bows.
Okay.
And I, how many are there? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9.
They're known as the nine bows. They are symbolic of Egypt's nine traditional enemies. I didn't look up to see who their nine traditional enemies are. So what does this picture show you then, now that you know that? He's on top. They're all subdued underneath of him. Pharaoh controls the enemies of Egypt. And the enemies of Egypt are foreigners, people that are not Egyptian. And that's part of the important culture of Egypt. All right? Pharaoh's set up by the gods to keep control, to keep chaos from coming to pass in Egypt. And what is the book of Exodus, chapters 1 to 15, all about? Chaos in Egypt. Pharaoh powerless to do anything about it. And the chaos not only is destroying Egypt, but it's brought on by who? Foreigners. And a foreign god. It's a reversal. Just what Egypt preached and modeled is not going to happen. Okay, one more. Then we'll wrap up. I saw, and I was going to put a picture, and I couldn't find it at the last minute, but I saw a picture of what appeared to be some, you know, some Egyptian fighters, or at least Middle Eastern fighters, on chariots. And it said, the caption said, total war. Total war, that third word, I forget what it was. I don't know what the point of that was, because I'm not sure what the website was. But, you know, we have drones, and we have guided missiles, and we have all kinds of high-tech weapons. In the 12th century, 13th century, 14th, 15th, whatever century you think the Exodus was in, B.C., what was the high-tech weaponry? You're looking at it. That was the high-tech weaponry then. And the only people who had that were the people who had what? Money. Cost money to do what? Feed horses, build chariots, pay people to ride the chariots. Again, you had to have a pretty prosperous society to afford an armed forces that could afford to have a chariot, you know, a chariot army. That costs a lot of money. So you had to have a prosperous society that somehow or another could fund that, what amounts to a huge defense budget. And at the time of the Exodus, as far as I'm aware, there were two kingdoms who could afford this in the general area. One was the Egyptian kingdom, and one was the Hittite kingdom. And occasionally they had their battles. These are reliefs from the Temple of Luxor. You probably can't see too much there. But they are both supposed to be, they're separate pictures, but they're carved into the rock there at the Temple of Luxor, and they're supposed to depict the Battle of Kadesh, which was in the 13th century B.C., between the Hittites and the Egyptians. And depending on whose account you read of that battle, it was a great victory for Egypt or a great victory for the Hittites. You didn't write about your defeats. Apparently, best the historians can tell is that it was kind of a stalemate. But if you read the account, the Egyptian account, it sounds like they had a great victory. But they didn't. In fact, they lost a lot of people and a lot of chariots. In the water, interestingly enough. So this was the high-tech weaponry of the day, and the Egyptians had plenty of it. They had plenty of chariots. And who had them? It was the king. The king was the only one who had the money, had the ability to have a standing army like this. So that's who had them. So a chariot is, it's kind of like, in a way, this is, if I can make an analogy, it's like a gun. If I were to have a gun in my hand, that's an extension of my power, isn't it? Or maybe it's only power I have. But if I wanted to exert my control, my hegemony over something or somebody else, to have a gun or have some kind of a weapon does that. And that's exactly the purpose of a chariot in these times. It projected your power. You're pharaoh, you're only one person, you control a powerful country and so forth, and you have your own chariot and your own charioteer and all that kind of stuff. But it was a projection of your power. Also, the chariots, and this is just a hint at what I was talking about before about the virility of the pharaoh and the way it was portrayed in the arts and so forth, and I won't go any further than that, but just to say that chariot horses were not geldings. They were stallions, all right? They were stallions. They were the only ones spirited enough. And the iconography of the armies show that, you know, that they were stallions. And it's all part of the projection of power. So in depictions of the battles between the Egyptians and the Hittites and any of their enemies, you see these chariots and the horses. And this is very indicative of the power. The power that these societies claim to have. And this might be the most important, I don't know how to say most important, but maybe the most obvious. This was, as much as anything else, the chariot brigades or whatever it was that they had there in Egypt, it was as much or more than anything else the symbol of their power projected to the rest of the world. That they, it's kind of like the United States today. Now, who would want to fight the United States in a conventional type of war? The United States at this current time just has more firepower than pretty much everybody else put together. It would be foolish to take them on. And it was the same way at this time. Nobody's going to take on Egypt except for the Hittites. You know, they had, it's kind of like Russia and America back in the Cold War. You had two powers that had enough armaments between them to wipe out anybody and everybody else, but they were at a kind of a stalemate themselves. But here you had the symbol. The whole chariot army was a symbol of the power of these nations, and particularly Egypt. And I'm going to read from Exodus chapter 14, beginning in verse 1. The Lord spoke unto Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, that they turn and encamp before Pi-Hahiroth, or however you say that, in Migdol in the sea. This is up north, kind of near where those lakes I was showing you, up that way. And Pharaoh will think, I've got him caught between the wilderness. And the wilderness has shut him out. I've got him caught between us and the sea, the Mediterranean, plus these lakes. The wilderness has shut them in. And I will harden Pharaoh's heart, and he will follow after them. And I will be honored among Pharaoh and among his host, his army, that the Egyptians may know that I am the Lord. Reading on, verse 5. And it was told the king this, and he said, you know, we've got all these Egyptians. What are we going to let them go for? And verse 6 says, he made ready his chariot, and took his people with him. And verse 7 says, he took 100 chosen chariots with all the chariots of Egypt and captains over every one of them. And it says, the Lord hardened the heart of Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, and pursued after the children of Israel. And the children of Israel went out with a high hand, but the Egyptians pursued them, all the horses and chariots of Pharaoh. And it keeps saying horses and chariots. Obviously, if you have chariots, you have to have horses, but it's making a point here. This is the extension of Pharaoh's power. This is the way he was portrayed to his enemies. All of his horsemen, all of his chariots, all of his horses overtook them, encamping by the sea. Skipping down to verse 17. And behold, I will harden the hearts of the Egyptians, and they shall follow them, and I will get honor upon Pharaoh and upon all his hosts and upon his chariots and upon his horsemen. Well, there God's being clear. I'm going to get honor. You know, Pharaoh is trying to get honor. Pharaoh is projecting his power to the rest of the world. But I'm going to get honor over him. And the Egyptians shall know that I am the Lord, that I am Yahweh, when I have gotten honor upon Pharaoh and upon his chariots and upon his horsemen. How many times are we going to say upon his chariots and upon his horsemen? It's there again and again. Why is it there? Because that is the symbol of his power. And God was destroying it. Verse 22, the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on dry ground, the ocean, the waters on the right and left. The Egyptians pursued and went in after them into the midst of the sea, even all Pharaoh's horses, his chariots, and his horsemen. And it came to pass in the morning watch that the Lord looked through the host of the Egyptians, through the army that is, and the pillar and the fire and the cloud, and troubled the army of the Egyptians and took off their chariot wheels, drove them heavily. Verse 26 and says, the Lord said to Moses, stretch out your hand upon the sea, and the waters have come again upon the Egyptians, upon their chariots, and upon their horsemen. And Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and it returned to his strength. When the morning appeared, the Egyptians fled. And verse 28 says, the waters returned and covered the chariots and the horsemen and all the hosts of the army of Pharaoh that came unto the sea after them, and it remained not much of one of them. God was getting honor over Egypt and all that was symbolized by that we've talked about, but especially over the chariots and the horsemen, because they were what, more than anything else. In fact, here's a picture, I should have had this before now, of you know, an Egyptian, well, I don't know if it's a pharaoh, but an Egyptian and his chariot. And look at the horse. The horse is trampling the foreign enemies. The horse is trampling them. But how did it end up? God destroyed them, didn't he? God destroyed them. Egypt was one of the great powers of the earth. Yahweh took each of their symbols of power and security, and he demonstrated his sovereignty over all. He demonstrated his power over all of that. Things that should be up, if you were an Egyptian, things that should be up were down. And things that should be down were up. Everything was reversed. The powers of this world had no power over God, and they still don't. Yahweh is the God of the oppressed and the downtrodden, not the God of Pharaoh and the chariots and the horsemen. He's the God of the weak of the world. And after thousands of years, the Exodus continues to encourage and inspire. May you have a wonderful spring festival, and I'll be thinking of you from a very hot and muggy Thailand.